This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're going to hear today about two movies, and they're getting a lot of attention right now. Billy Eichner's Bros and Blonde, based on Joyce Carol Oates' novel about the life of Marilyn Monroe. But let's start with our contributor, Josh Yaffa, who is on the ground reporting in Ukraine. And what we're seeing is absolutely stunning. A counterattack in Ukraine that has Russian forces in retreat. Vladimir Putin reacting by calling up recruits and threatening nuclear war. And distinct signs of political rebellion and despair in Russia itself, as thousands of people have fled the country and many more are taking to the street in protest. Joshua Yaffa was based for years in Moscow, and since the war began, he's reported for us consistently from Ukraine. I reached him there last week. Hey, Josh, how are you?
Nice to talk to you.
I'm reaching you in Kyiv.
That's right. Yeah, I arrived a few days ago.
Now, the news that's coming out of Moscow, the news that's coming out of Ukraine is astonishing, and it's hard to know where to start. But Putin's mobilization effort seems to be a disaster in so many ways. It sparked protests at home, people leaving the country. How is it being received in Ukraine? Is there some sense of, weirdly, some sense of celebration about how badly it's gone?
I would actually say that the latest news out of Moscow has been treated in Ukraine with a kind of indifference almost. In other words, Ukraine has been in a fight for its survival since the end of February, full aware that Russia is ready to throw any and all resources at the attempted subjugation of the Ukrainian state. And after things like the massacre in Bucha and other areas outside of Kiev from earlier this spring, there's not much that can surprise or shock or scare the Ukrainian public about what Russia is ready to do.
Now, you've lived for years in Moscow, and recently you've been living elsewhere in Europe and been in and out of Ukraine a great deal. But I'm sure you're in touch with people in Moscow. Has the so-called bargain ended? The bargain in which Putin basically says, I will let you live your private lives if you stay out of politics. Are we suddenly seeing signs of politics on the streets of Moscow in a way that we haven't before?
I'm not so sure I would say we're yet seeing politics on the streets, but I think we are seeing politics emerge, at least in the consciousness of people's minds. There's a saying I've heard both among Russian acquaintances, also here in Ukraine, that on September 21st, the day when Putin announced this mobilization, that's when Russians really understood what had happened on February 24th. In other words, the Russian people, many of whom were able to live with this kind of illusion, or at least with the ability to not pay much attention to what was going on in Ukraine. There was polling done from places like the Levada Center, an institution I know you know well, really the last independent sociological research organization of its type left in Russia, that was showing by the summer, half of all Russians were paying little to no attention to what was happening in Ukraine. And that really is what Russians support, as it were, for the war boiled down to. It was support through not paying attention. Putin, as you mentioned, has imposed or sort of forced the Russian people to see themselves now as part of this war through mobilization. He simply didn't have the forces anymore in Ukraine to continue the fight. So he was really left with no choice but to go for this mobilization if he wanted to continue the war. But of course, in so doing, he has greatly upended the social and political contract that you described.
You're in Kyiv. You're talking to political leaders. You're talking to military leaders. How do they assess Ukraine's prospects in the coming months?
People here are, of course, optimistic. Certainly, the success in the Kharkiv region really emboldened a lot of people, both in society and in the military, that in fact, Russia could be defeated. That was an important proof of concept for a lot of people here. But I think that Ukraine now believes it has a path to victory that it's certainly going to continue to pursue.
Is Ukraine overconfident in that sense?
We'll see. I do think that the military balance of power fairly and objectively favors Ukraine. The question is, you know, will that actually translate into battlefield victory? It's one thing to keep Russian forces from sacking Kyiv, as Ukrainian military managed to do in the spring. It's another to dislodge them from positions in the south and the east that Russians have dug into now for months, or in the Donbass in some cases, for years.
Statistics are hard to come by, reliable statistics. I'm just reading a piece that David Cortava, our colleague, will have coming out in the magazine in a couple of days, in which he says that Mariupol, the city of Mariupol, was completely destroyed, and Russian forces had killed 21,000 residents and had bombed out 90% of the buildings in that city. Is there any sense of casualties on both sides?
Not really, I think, is the most fair answer. We have these estimates for military casualties. Ukraine has its own numbers saying, you know, upwards of 50,000, I think at this point, much higher than that. Russian soldiers killed, several thousand of its own killed. Russia has essentially the mirror image numbers about losses. Western intelligence services and governments have weighed in, also suggesting the losses certainly for Russia are extraordinarily high. As to the civilian toll, I think I'm afraid we know maybe even less about that. I think that there are thousands of uncounted losses in Ukraine, especially we take a place like Mariupol, now under Russian occupation. There was just a really ghoulish story today. I read just in the hours before we were having our conversation that the children's ombudswoman in Russia, a government official whose job is ostensibly to protect the rights of children, was talking about how Ukrainian children evacuated, you might say taken, stolen, out of Mariupol after it was sieged and taken by Russian forces, now have arrived in Russia, and they have undergone, as she put it, a positive trajectory from being critical of Putin and singing the Ukrainian anthem to now loving Russia and understanding the virtue of Russia's activities in Ukraine. And that, I think that gets to the really dark nature of this war, with real echoes of the Second World War. And we only see in really grim, tragic, scattershot ways like that story the overall human toll, which I think remains impossible to estimate.
Putin has made nuclear threats in the past and is still doing so. How is that being received in Ukraine?
Here, I think it's interesting to talk about a real dichotomy or difference of reaction in Ukraine and in the West. In Ukraine, that's another element of Putin's recent policies, recent escalation, that Ukrainians don't pay that much attention to. For Ukrainians, this war has been existential since the very beginning. I think Putin knows that either threatening to use a nuclear weapon or even deploying a small tactical one, small, relatively speaking, right, still horribly destructive with incredible human toll, wouldn't really scare off or deter Ukraine. I think the real audience for this kind of saber-rattling is the West. The idea is to scare the West off from continuing to support, encourage, and arm Ukraine for these continuing counteroffensives. And Putin's bet is that the West will be so freaked out by the very prospect of nuclear use that it will do anything it can to essentially pressure Kyiv to cut a deal. I'm not so sure that's going to work. If you hear the statements of people in the Biden administration, they don't seem to be at this stage buying into or all that scared by Putin's ratcheting up of the nuclear rhetoric. But you could imagine a scenario in which the triangle, you know, Moscow, Kiev, Washington, becomes more difficult, more fraught if these threats continue, and a different calculus around escalation and avoiding certainly nuclear escalation clicks into focus. You could potentially see some policy disagreements or friction between Washington and Kiev. Again, Kiev unable to be deterred, and Washington perhaps, if not can be deterred, certainly has a different calculus in thinking about the nuclear issue.
Josh, Kremlinology is always a mug's game ever since people tried to figure out where people were standing on Lenin's tomb during a May Day parade and figuring out, you know, the leadership intrigues from it.
Your one-time job.
I found it unbelievably intriguing that Putin would schedule a speech for a particular date, as he did last week, and then cancel at the last minute after keeping people waiting, having one of his officials tweet, you know, go to bed, we'll see you tomorrow. And then he gives the speech. It did not speak of great stability in the Kremlin. Is there any way to know what's going on when you read these reports from on Telegram from so-called Kremlin insiders talking about great instability? Do you believe them? And do you think that Putin is in political trouble to the extent where he may be overthrown?
I know very little and would put very little faith in anyone who claims to talk about actual palace intrigue inside the halls of the Kremlin. But there's enough evidence publicly available to certainly speak about some turbulence inside the ruling system writ large. And so you're seeing rifts emerge on state television, right? Different camps emerge even within the ruling system. And those kinds of dynamics are, by definition, destabilizing to the Putin system, which really had this vertical of power in which all members of the ruling system from top to bottom were on the same page. Now they're not on the same page. And I think that that can't be good for Putin and his continued rule.
Finally, Josh, it seems to me, tell me if I'm wrong, that the minimum Putin would accept, or signaling that he would accept to come to real negotiations, is that he gets to keep Crimea and eastern Ukraine, that he freezes into place a larger version of what he had before he came in. On the other hand, on the Ukrainian side, it seems to me unanimous as a position that Ukraine will not accept Russian presence in any part of Ukraine at all, including Crimea.
That's certainly the mood right now. And again, this it's hard to overestimate, at least as where we are late September, early October, the importance of the success of this Kharkiv counteroffensive, because that really proved to the Ukrainian people, the Ukrainian military, political leadership, that it's possible to kick out Russian forces from areas of Ukraine they occupy. And right now, that is absolutely the intent and the mood. And as long as that continues to seem possible and realistic, I don't think neither the Ukrainian people nor the Ukrainian political leadership will agree to anything less than that. But that's where we are now. If this Kharkiv counteroffensive in some months turns out to have been a one-off success, and there isn't much more Ukrainian success in the south toward Kherson, in the east toward Donbass, in pushing back Russian forces and recapturing occupied territory, then perhaps that mood could shift toward some sort of willingness to consider a negotiated settlement. That's a difficult conversation to try and raise in Kiev these days. You immediately get told that that's not on the table. But of course, wars are fluid, unpredictable processes. And if it gets to be winter, it's cold in Ukraine, there's difficulty with energy supplies, inflation is going up, it's more expensive, the economy continues to take a hit, the real medium and long-term costs of the war become more and more apparent, and Ukraine hasn't managed to take back much more territory, you could imagine a different conversation. But for now, that's really speculative.
Josh Offa, thanks so much. Stay safe, my friend.
Thank you.
Joshua Yaffa, we spoke on Wednesday. You can read Josh on Ukraine as well as reporting on the war from Masha Gessen, Luke Mogelson, and more at NewYorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hold up. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. You probably came across the comedian and actor Billy Eichner the same way I did. Somebody probably sent you a video of this manic guy running around New York City quizzing passersby on questions like, is this a real Tyler, the Creator lyric or not? Did you hear that Madonna died? And would you have sex with Paul Rudd for a dollar?
Let's go! Miss, for a dollar, would you have sex with Paul Rudd? That's Paul Rudd.
Of course I would.
Yes, thank you. Here's a dollar. Miss, for a dollar, would you have sex with Paul Rudd?
Yeah.
Yes, here's a dollar. Here, would you?
Billy on the Street was designed to go viral, and it did. Madonna even had the good sense not to sue him. A decade later, Billy Eichner is starring in a form of comedy that, by contrast, you'd almost call serious and respectable. A romantic comedy called Bros.
I loved rom-coms. I grew up in New York City, in Queens, and my parents and I, one of the ways we bonded is by going to movies. And I loved entertainment, loved Hollywood from a very young age. I don't know how that happened, but it just happened. I can't remember my life before I wasn't interested in that. And there was a period of my life when my parents and I would go to the movies every single Saturday night, yeah, regardless of whether there was even something we really wanted to see or not. Like, we were just big moviegoers, and I loved romantic comedies. Those were honestly some of the movies I looked forward to seeing most, and the movies I have returned to again and again over the years.
What were some of your favorites?
I saw, if you're old enough like me to remember, when the major studios used to do sneak previews of movies,
yeah,
which they don't do anymore, but they would show you the whole movie a week before it came out. And so my parents and I went to see a sneak preview of When Harry Met Sally at the Fresh Meadows Cineplex Odeon in Queens. I remember seeing Moonstruck. I remember seeing Working Girl. I remember watching Broadcast News and Tootsie, and just so many movies like that, which I love. The Nora Ephron movies, Sleepless in Seattle, as I got older, You've Got Mail, My Best Friend's Wedding. Oh, I remember I saw Pretty Woman at the Lowe's Trilon in Queens on Queens Boulevard. I don't know why I have I can tell you, I don't only remember the movies, but for some reason, especially with those movies, because I love them so much, I remember where I saw them. In some cases, I remember where I was sitting in the movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
I was always a kid who, I don't know if it was because I was gay or smart or a bit of an overachiever. I always wanted to be an adult, and those movies made me feel like I was an adult, even though there were never any gay people in them.
Well, this is what we're heading toward, obviously. You're watching all these movies, one after the other, dozens of them, and And at the same time, you're a young gay kid growing up and getting older. And as they say now constantly, you're not seeing yourself on screen.
Right.
How does that make you feel one way or another?
Well, as a kid, I wasn't really thinking about that. You know, I mean, this was the 80s and the 90s. I didn't come out until I was in college. I obviously knew I was gay before that, but it wasn't something that was front of mind. But at the time, I can say I sat around and thought as a 12-year-old, why aren't there any gay people in Sleepless in Seattle? You know, I was just following the story, and but I was feeling it. You know, and now looking back, it's true, because in those movies, as much as I love them, you know, you're not the, if you're a gay guy or an LGBTQ person watching Sleepless in Seattle, for one example, you're not quite the Tom Hanks and you're not quite the Meg Ryan, and yet you're longing to feel the way that those characters do and to have those experiences. And even though there weren't LGBTQ characters present in those movies at that time, it's still, they made me feel like there would be a world of smart adults out there going through complicated things involving love and relationships and affairs. And I just really wanted to be a part of that. And even though I wasn't seeing gay characters, I was seeing adults. And I guess in my mind, I connected that to a more sophisticated world than the one I was living in, where there would probably be a spot for me, even though I wasn't seeing myself specifically.
Billy, tell me about how this movie came about and why.
Well, strangely enough, Bros started with two straight men, the director and my co-writer, Nick Stoller, who I'd worked with as an actor a couple of times, but never as a co-writer. He emailed me in the, I believe the fall of 2017, and said, I want my next movie to be a romantic comedy, because he loves rom-coms. But he said he thought it would be cool if it was about a gay couple, because he knew we hadn't got many of those. But he acknowledged, which I knew, that he was a straight man and married to a woman for many years. And they have three young daughters and, you know, leading a, what we would now refer to as a very heteronormative lifestyle. But he said, I love working with you. And do you want to write it with me? And if all goes well, you could star in it, I'll direct it. And he mentioned that Judd Apatow, sort of this blockbuster comedy producer, would hopefully probably come on board as our producer, because Judd had also been looking for a story like this. And those two guys have made some of the biggest comedy blockbusters of the past 25 years between the two of them, Bridesmaids and, you know, 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Neighbors, Superbad. The list goes on and on.
Tell me about the process of writing the film. What was your intent? What you wanted to make sure was there? Because this is not just When Harry Met Sally becomes When Harry Met Harry, or, you know, with the chromosome.
Exactly.
It's different things happen.
Yeah.
Sexually, socially, it's different.
Absolutely. And honestly, that's exactly one of the first things I said to Nick when he came to me with the invitation. I said, I'm very flattered. I've never started a movie before. I've never written a movie before. I don't know why you think I can do this. I obviously want to take you up on it. It's a huge opportunity for me and for the LGBTQ community, because Judd and Nick are two guys on an increasingly short list that can get an R-rated comedy greenlit at a major studio and released in theaters. So I knew it was a huge opportunity, but I told him right off the bat, I said, the main thing is that the movie is laugh out loud funny. We're all comedy guys, and that's our job. But also, it has to be honest, and it has to be authentic. And I literally said to him, if you think we can just do When Harry Met Sally and slip in two guys and have the story play out the same way, I'm not interested.
What is that? But what does that mean, When Harry Met Sally? In other words, what is, it's because it's too polite, it's too sedate. I would say there's marginally more group sex in your film than in When Harry Met Sally.
So.
I don't remember any orgies in that film.
No. I just think, you know, two men together is different. You know, by the way, I think even for a lot of straight couples, especially a lot of younger straight couples, the old rules of those romantic comedies don't apply to them either. You know, we are a more liberated society, and I love those movies, and I still love them, even though they read to me as a bit old-fashioned. So what we were trying to do with Bros is give you that same uplifting, warm, comforting feeling that you get from the best of those movies, but update it you know, and make it about a more modern, contemporary couple, right? You know, and also we have to be careful. You can't talk about gay men or LGBTQ people as a monolithic group.
In any way. Yeah, in any way.
But a lot of, you know, the gay men I know, especially compared to straight people, or at least straight people as they're portrayed in the media and in culture, we do, you know, we play by our own rules sometimes, you know?
So give me an example of that. Give me a scene that's an example of that, that you would, there's no way you would find in a, you know, When Harry Met Sally.
You know, at one point early in the movie, two of my best friends who have been dating for a while, they reveal that they're now in a throuple, that they are now, as a couple, dating a third person. And, you know, and my character isn't necessarily judgmental of throuples. My character is judgmental of romantic relationships in general. And, you know, underneath there, there's a bit of a bitterness. You know, I think there was once a line in the movie, wow, you found two, I can't find one. You know what I mean?
I love the one, there's a moment when one of the members of the throuple calls his parents, imaginatively or otherwise, and informs them that I'm now, a verb that I can't use on the airwaves necessarily, two other guys. And the parents react with absolute acceptance and glee. Fantastic.
Oh, they're so thrilled. They're so like, thrilled. Oh, you're finally in a throuple. We're so happy. You know, now that's a bit of a, that's like almost like an Annie Hall inspired fantasy sequence.
Right.
But it's also a reflection of an evolving world. I mean, I know a lot of throuples in real life. My best friends in the world are a married couple, two gay men. I was the witness at their wedding. They're two lifelong friends. They've been together 18 years, married 10 years, but have now been in a throuple with a third man for about 6 or 7 years, which I always tell them is three times as long as I've ever been in a relationship with one other person.
It's also a great joke. This is also the notion of a gender reveal orgy.
Yes, my boyfriend tells me that he's going to a gender reveal orgy. a married gay couple he knows is having a baby through a surrogate, and they're announcing the gender to the world by having a gender reveal orgy, not just a party. You know, and you know, we are both mocking and spoofing and celebrating what I tend to think is of a very sexually liberated gay population. Now, I also know tons of gay friends in monogamous relationships with each other that, you know, you could call it heteronormative or old-fashioned or traditional, whatever word. I know plenty of those, too. I don't want to paint a picture here as gay men, as these, like, you know, out-of-control, yeah, promiscuous, crazy people. But here's what happens. When culture and society at large, for the vast majority of human existence, does not want to talk about the private lives of gay people and LGBTQ people and essentially erases us from the mainstream narrative, from textbooks, from history, what happens is two things happen. A, that it can traumatize that population to a certain degree. That's the negative. If there is a positive that comes out of society ignoring you or scapegoating you or vilifying you, whatever you want to say, it means that you end up saying, you know what, okay, I don't want to curse. You know, forget it. We're going to go make up our own rules. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to do what feels good to us. Marriage may not be the answer. It's lovely to have the ability to marry each other now, and we certainly all deserve equal protection under the law. But maybe we don't want to get married ever. Maybe we want to get married and continue to have sex with other people, and that works for us. You know, maybe we have an open relationship without getting married. You know, maybe we're polyamorous. The culture ignoring us for a long time gave us the ability to sort of go in a dark corner and decide what felt good to us. And I think that's a wonderful thing about being part of the queer community, because those old-fashioned rules of those rom-coms that I grew up loving, I love watching them, and they maybe work for some people, but even among straight people, they don't work. We all know how many straight relationships fall apart. And so I think that's what we're reflecting in Bros, and the premise that Judd Apatow and Nick Stoller and I started off with was, what happens when two 40-something-year-old gay men who have both been out their whole lives, are very sexually active, but have put romance and intimacy at arm's length. These characters, both me and my love interest Aaron, played by Luke McFarlane, we, at the beginning of the movie, pride ourselves on being impenetrable. they're both learning to be vulnerable. And the idea that we started off with was, what happens when two men who pride themselves on not needing romance, who pride themselves on being self-reliant, which is something that LGBTQ folks have always had to be, what happens when those two men in the middle of their lives meet someone for the first time and really fall in love?
Honestly, I was impressed. You may be more emotionally unavailable than I am.
Well, maybe we can be emotionally unavailable together.
Maybe we can be emotionally unavailable together? Who's writing your texts, Maroon 5?
Fuck off.
Kidding. We can go out. Are you asking me out?
I'm down for whatever.
Yeah, same.
Cool.
Sounds good.
So, tomorrow?
Or we can do whenever. Yeah, I can do whenever, and I can do whatever.
I don't care what we
Billy,
do.
Billy, yeah, me neither. At a certain point, Hollywood felt very proud of itself for having movies with, as it were, gay themes. Philadelphia came out. Brokeback Mountain. They used straight actors, Tom Hanks and the rest. It seemed to me that even though you were working with a co-writer and a director who's straight, with Judd Apatow, who is as well, that casting was another matter. Talk to me about your decisions about casting, because I believe the vast majority of the cast that you work with is gay, queer, with the exception of Deborah Messing and Kristen Chenoweth.
Yes, with the exception of a few celebrity cameos, which are really some of the highlights of the movie. They just crush. It's so funny. But yeah, all the main and supporting roles in the movie are all played by openly LGBTQ actors. Even the straight characters in the movie are played by openly LGBTQ actors. And that's something that with this particular movie being the first of its kind, you know, the first R-rated gay rom-com from a major studio. It's going to be playing in movie theaters, you know, in big multiplexes. The same ones that play Batman and Spider-Man are going to have this Judd Apatow-produced R-rated gay rom-com playing in them. That is an enormous amount of access and reach that movies like this have never gotten before, and it took way too long to get here. But I wanted to take advantage of that moment and to say, hey, LGBTQ actors have been left out of this equation for so long. And no one's making any rules about, oh, gay should play gay and straight should play straight. It's acting, right? It's art. Art is a liberating force. You don't want to put any strict rules on it. And the whole fun of acting for both actors and the audience is to watch actors transform into someone else. That's all true. I don't think there should be any, you know, strict regulations on who plays what. However, art, especially major studio films, are a big business. They are not made in a vacuum. And historically, the most high-profile LGBTQ roles, the ones that were visible, the ones that did get marketing, the ones that did get a lot of media attention, the ones that got big awards campaigns built around them, in almost all those scenarios, all those roles are played by straight movie stars, right? And some of those performances were magnificent. Right? No one's arguing with how wonderful Sean Penn was in Milk, or Tom Hanks in Philadelphia, or Heath Ledger in Brokeback Mountain. The list goes on. However, we never got to play our own roles, ever. You know, maybe in indie films we did, but those films were never given the financial support that they needed to get to a wider audience, to get the type of distribution that a Brokeback Mountain or a Philadelphia or even a Milk would get. Right? And so we took this as an opportunity with Bros to say, first of all, so many of the movies you made, Hollywood, were about the tragedy of being gay, the suffering, the closet, AIDS. You know, I think actors were drawn to those roles, especially straight actors, because, you know, giving them the benefit of the doubt, they wanted to bring gay stories to the screen. And also, I think they saw them as ways that they could really prove their acting chops. With watch me as a straight man that you all know transform myself into this gay victim, right? And everyone won awards and got acclaim and all of this stuff, and we were left out.
Was that maddening to you?
Over time, to the degree that it happened, yes, because it never worked in the reverse. Openly LGBTQ actors never got to play the main straight roles in big movies, and then we're also not getting to play the main gay roles.
They were closeted. Unless it was Rock Hudson.
Well, sure, but that's a different thing.
Sure.
You know, and
that's tragic in its own way.
Tragic in its own way. And you know, for so long, LGBTQ people in Hollywood, actors, and also even people behind the scenes, writers, directors, especially if you wanted to work on films or TV shows of a certain scale. That weren't small, low-budget films, you had two choices up until, I don't know, 10 years ago. You could be bold enough to come out of the closet, and everyone would pat you on the back and say, oh, that's so brave and so bold, and then they wouldn't give you a job, right? Or you could stay in the closet like Rock Hudson's and many of those guys and women and trans people. You could stay in the closet and you could maybe work and become a movie star if you were lucky like Rock Hudson did, but you had to lead some strange double life. Those guys were being set up in fake relationships with women, so the public thought they were straight so they could continue to pursue their professional and artistic dreams. Those were the two options, and those are terrible options. That's not a humane thing to do to a person.
Billy, I know you've been staying up, I know because I've read it, that you've been staying up worrying that the film might not appeal to a huge audience because this is not a cheap movie. You didn't make it with a video camera and two light bulbs. Universal's got a rom-com coming out soon called Ticket to Paradise. It's got George Clooney and Julia Roberts. And nobody's going to be asking Julia Roberts and George Clooney in their interviews, are they worried that gay people are going to come to see their movie?
Right, exactly.
What's your concern here? And what do you think is going to happen?
I don't worry about whether the movie appeals to straight people. We just had our world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival in a theater full of 1,700 people, the vast majority of whom were straight, because the vast majority of the audience is still straight. You don't hear about it much, but straight people are still out there and thriving. And we've had so many screenings across the country over the past few months, test screenings and screenings for press. And they love the movie. For some reason, because of COVID and maybe just a change in the way content is served up, Hollywood decided a few years ago that comedy is something that you watch at home by yourself. And all these comedy films are now getting released to streaming platforms. And yes, that's very convenient and lovely. And of course, I watch a lot of stuff at home too, as we all do. But I am telling you, we have forgotten how much fun it is to sit with other people and laugh and cry and be moved together as a group. I don't worry about it appealing to straight audiences. What I worry about is whether a straight audience sees the trailer for Bros and thinks, oh, wow, a movie about a gay couple. That's for me. I'll be able to relate to that. When I know that they will, but I hope that they realize that because Hollywood has not conditioned them to think these movies are for everyone because they never made movies like this that were for everyone and given this level of distribution. So that's what I worry about. I hope that straight people, anyone who wants to see a good comedy and laugh out loud, embraces this, even if you're not seeing yourself reflected specifically because, like I said, as a kid, as an adult even, all the rom-coms I saw were always about straight people, and yet I related. I laughed, I cried, I wanted to be up on screen, and there's no reason to think straight people shouldn't have that same experience when it's a gay couple, but there's not much of a precedent for it. That's where the fear comes in, right? So, you know, I hope that I'm worrying for no reason, but I'd be lying to say I wasn't worried.
Billy Eichner, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Bros is opening in theaters this weekend, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The novelist Joyce Carol Oates has the literary energy of a 19th century figure like Charles Dickens or Anthony Trollope. She's the author of 60 novels and hundreds of short stories and countless enigmatic, often controversial tweets. Lately, one volume in particular has gotten renewed attention. It's a book called Blonde, about Norma Jean Baker, who became Marilyn Monroe.
It's widely considered to be her masterwork. It's more than 700 pages. I think it clocks at like 738, so it's her longest book. And apparently the draft was twice as long.
Katie Waldman is a staff writer for The New Yorker who covers books and culture.
I think it's the best version of a lot of themes that she's been toying with and unpacking for her entire career. Marilyn Monroe is just, in a way, she's just a succession of incredible stills or photographs, right? She's this iconic figure who is both woman and so much more than woman, myth, blonde, fairy tale princess, symbol of Hollywood.
Blonde was published in 2000, and it's just now become the basis for a film on Netflix written and directed by Andrew Dominik.
Miss Monroe, it's time!
You told your biographer that you were inspired to write the book after seeing a photo of the 15-year-old Norma Jean Baker.
Yes.
And you said, this young, hopefully smiling girl, so very American, reminded me powerfully of girls of my childhood, some of them from broken homes.
Oh, yes. Well, I came from an upstate New York, western New York, north of Buffalo. It was not a very prosperous community that I lived in. And there were broken homes, and there was a good deal of brutality. Mm-hmm. So my family was actually quite unusual. My parents and my brother and I lived with my mother's parents. So we had like a multi-generational farmhouse, and we were more of a stable family. But I went to school with these other girls who were often victimized. Mm. Their fathers may have been drinking, or they may have been ill, or they abandoned the family. There was a lot of poverty.
Yeah.
Norma Jean Baker is one of those girls. She was in many foster homes, but she was not an orphan because her mother was alive. It's just that her mother couldn't take care of her.
I was thinking about Marilyn Monroe and about Hannah, the rich, elegant blonde at the heart of Babysitter, your most recent novel. Some of your most iconic creations have been seemingly pure blonde women who may be despoiled. The depictions are so evocative, it seems like it must have some sort of special fascination for you.
Well, it's hard to say. You know, I'm probably drawn to writing about relative underdogs or people who've been marginalized or impoverished or disenfranchised. They don't necessarily have to be blonde girls or women. They could also be men. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've written about boxing.
Right, right.
These are like working class Americans who had no unions to protect them. And basically, I'm sort of interested, I think predominantly, there might be a theme where I'm interested in marginalized people who've been exploited by the establishment.
Yeah.
I was probably drawn to writing about Marilyn Monroe because she did exemplify the kind of person who was a victim, who really didn't have any protection. She was like a girl, like in a fairy tale, like the beggar maid. Mm. And she had to make her own way. So she was working in a factory when she was only about 16, and she was doing the kind of work where she was breathing in fumes.
Yeah.
So I guess the point I'm making is that Norma Jean Baker, had she not become a starlet and then Marilyn Monroe, she would have been sort of used up by the world, you know, of capitalism. And mm-hmm. So that's probably what I'm drawn to more than there being a blonde woman.
Everything's all right. Norma Jean, what were you thinking of?
I wasn't thinking. maybe I was remembering.
How did the film come about?
Well, Andrew Dominik wrote a screenplay, which he sent to me a long time ago. I was very impressed with that because he had distilled about 800 pages down into, you know, like a two-hour movie.
Were you pleased with how it turned out?
Oh, yes. It's a work of art. Andrew Dominik is a very idiosyncratic director. So he appropriated the subject and made it into his own vision. It's extremely emotionally exhausting. It's not a feel-good movie. It's not at all like most movies about Marilyn Monroe are kind of upbeat. This one really is probably what she was actually experiencing.
Yeah.
I did have to stop watching it and go away for a couple of hours and then come back. It's very demanding of the viewer.
Yeah.
Well, the last quarter of it, perhaps, is very hallucinatory. As Marilyn Monroe at this point is addicted to barbiturates.
Please come. Please come. Don't abandon me. Please.
She's coming.
Please come.
She's coming.
Don't abandon me.
She's coming. She's almost here.
That's quite astonishingly vivid and realistic. And you sort of feel that you're losing your own mind, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's a movie not for the faint of heart. But, you know, the real things that happened to Marilyn Monroe are much worse than anything in this movie. It's a superb job of acting. Ana de Armas becomes Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
I mean, some actors are really like chameleons.
Yeah, well, Norma Jean Baker was a chameleon too. I guess there was no Marilyn Monroe who wasn't sort of a performance.
Yeah, yes, that's true.
That's just a bit of Katie Waldman's conversation with Joyce Carol Oates, and you can read the entire interview at newyorker.com. To close the show today, we're going to hear just a little of Caleb Crane's short story, Easter, which was recently published in The New Yorker. Easter is set during a college student's visit with his family. And in the story, the boy is writing in his journal, something quite familiar to Crane himself. "I've kept a journal since I was a kid," he told us, "and it's frustrating how often I didn't write in it about what in retrospect seems like the important story. When I set out to plunder the journal for my fiction, I have to read like a detective. What was I leaving out?"
No one had sat down in the seat next to him, and the cabin doors were shut now, so it looked like he was going to have some privacy. He unzipped his backpack and took out a composition notebook that he had started using as a journal. He wanted to write about his visit to Stu Rossiter. In Houston, he had been staying with his grandmother on his father's side, and on Tuesday he had borrowed her car and driven down to Galveston to spend the night at Stu's. When he had explained the visit to his grandmother, he had called Stu a friend, but he didn't know if he really had the right to use that word. Whenever he and Stu had got stoned in the dorm, it had always been as part of a group. This visit was the first time Jacob and Stu had planned to do anything together, just the two of them. When the highway reached Galveston, it relaxed into a broad 19th century avenue. Slope-shouldered live oaks shaded the median. Stu's parents, who were both doctors, were still at work when Jacob arrived, and Stu immediately led Jacob upstairs, taking the steps two at a time, through the bedroom, furnished with twin beds, that Stu had shared with his older brother when he was growing up. Jacob was to sleep in the brother's bed that night. And out onto a porch, almost the whole footprint of which was occupied by a collapsed, weather-beaten pink sofa, which stank of mold, a smell almost too sharp for Jacob to convince himself that he could come to like it, that he could learn to be at home with it. On the sofa beside Jacob, Stu rolled a joint. "Many a proud voyage hath this pink galleon sailed," he said. He had found his parents' stash once, he told Jacob. It had been in a sandwich baggie inside a canister of cotton balls in the master bathroom. So they were cool with him taking a toke now and then, probably. It was a beautiful Texas spring afternoon, with terracotta light and a breeze that felt like someone lifting a sheet off you. Stu was shirtless, as he almost always was, because he was a kicker for the football team and as absurdly beautiful as he and Jacob were now becoming absurdly high. "Do you feel it?" Stu asked. He seemed to mean the diagonal of sun that was at that moment slicing across Jacob's right elbow. But how had he known that that was what was anchoring and filling Jacob's perception? "You mean..." For some reason, Jacob hesitated to put the touch on his elbow into words. "Yeah, you're feeling it," Jacob laughed. There was something in the way the drug separated the parts of thinking that maybe Jacob, if he persisted in experimenting with it, would someday become the first person in all of history to understand. "Let's catch some rays," Stu said. They went back downstairs. In the Rossiter's backyard, Stu handed Jacob a towel. Stu lay down, and Jacob understood that he was supposed to stretch out beside him. He took off his own shirt. Through his closed eyes, the sun blanketed him and isolated him from everything in the world. After a while, he turned his head to one side and opened one eye at a time. This was one of the parts he wanted to write about now on the plane. The view out of each eye had been slightly different, and it had started to seem as if he were a little person inside his own skull, running up and down stairs to look out the window on each floor. The pilot was announcing that they were beginning their descent to the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. Jacob closed his notebook and held it out in front of him. His hands were shaking, but only a bit worse than usual. When he was little, a doctor had told him that if the tremor in his hands wasn't caused by a serious illness, it would go away when he drank. And he had recently discovered that when he drank, it did go away. But he kept forgetting to check what it did when he was stoned.
That's an excerpt from Caleb Crane's story, Easter, and you can hear the entire story on our podcast, The Writer's Voice. And you can read it, of course, at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and that's our episode for today. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tuneyards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Mputubwele,
along with Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, Jenny Lawton, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline, Scott Gurian, and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.